Hi, this is Howard Massey. I'm a recording engineer and author, and I recently had the pleasure of co-authoring Beatles engineer Jeff Emerick's memoir entitled Here, There, and Everywhere.
So let me get clear about your kind of personal experience. What year were you born?
I was born in 1953, and so I was 11 years old when the Beatles first made their appearance over here, and I remember it so clearly, and it made such an impact on my life.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
And so that was, you know, essentially the epicenter of the invasion.
Pretty much, just a few miles away from the Warwick Hotel. I have a very vivid memory of the winter of 1964, and I was home with, I don't know if it was chicken pox or measles or one of those, and I just remember being glued to the TV from the moment the Beatles touched down at Kennedy Airport and had that press conference and all of the images of the screaming girls. And you literally could not tune in a single radio station in New York without hearing a Beatles song or a disc jockey, you know, feverishly talking about, they're here, they're here.
Yeah, I'll have to send you my documentary on the Beatles in America 1964, which goes into some depth about the New York radio wars.
Mm-hmm.
So,
You know, I was, as I said, I was 11 years old, so I was such an impressionable age. And I had heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, I guess, maybe a month before the Ed Sullivan appearance. And I just remember just my mouth dropping, my jaw dropping, just being mesmerized. The music was so different than anything else I'd ever heard before. And in fact, that single was the first record I ever bought in my entire life. And 35 years later, I had the privilege of meeting George Martin, and I sort of, I broke the journalist's unwritten rule and asked him to autograph it for me. And it's this tattered old sleeve from 1964, and he sort of looked at it, and he said, "My God, you don't want me to sign this. I'll ruin it." I said, "No, no, please, ruin away." So that's one of my prized possessions.
Excellent. So you are right in the heart of the Beatle generation, and as I'm presuming from the enthusiasm that you're expressing here, that you followed their every record, every album, and every development. And I'm wondering then, as you were aging up and getting to be 14, 15 years old, the Beatles were evolving themselves, bringing us to 1966 and 1967 when what they were presenting to their fans could be challenging. Did you feel challenged by, how the Beatles were experimenting and evolving?
I did, and I have to admit...
I'm sorry, Howard, let me... Sure. I forgot to give one other instruction. Even though we might post this as an interview on the web, almost everything will be extracted from your comments. So when I ask a question like that, kind of... as you start to answer it, sort of invert it so that it's clear where you're heading.
Gotcha.
You understand?
Gotcha.
Okay.
I did find their music in 1966 and 67 extremely challenging. And I guess I'll
just go ahead and say this one more thing. So yeah. In that instance, then the best way to work this so that it is clean and clear is instead of saying there or it or them, to say the Beatles.
Gotcha. Okay. I did find the change in the Beatles' music and their artistic direction very challenging in 1966 and 67. And as embarrassing as it is, I have to admit I didn't like it at first. Revolver as an album did not grab me right away. It took me years for it to really grow on me. When Sgt. Pepper came out in 1967, it did make a very immediate impression. And I thought the music was phenomenal and was zoning in particularly on Paul's bass playing. But I still longed for the days of the mop tops and the 3-minute hummable songs. It took a while for me to really kind of accept the fact that they had made this very drastic change, not only in their music, but in their image as well.
Do you have a copy of the album there?
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
I mean, I think I mentioned in my email, is I've asked people to talk about it, and they sort of handle it and look at it. That what impressions or memories come up about actually, absorbing this unusual package back in 1967?
the strongest memory I have of listening to Sgt. Pepper for the first time is listening to it completely through, nonstop. Of course, it was vinyl, so you had to stop it at the end of side one and turn it over. But listening to the album through with a close friend of mine, we were both 14 years old, and not saying a word to each other from start to finish. It was an experience. It wasn't a collection of songs. And the effect as a whole was you felt as if you'd been on some incredible journey. And I remember how excited we were when the last note of that piano chord at the end of A Day in the Life faded away. And our immediate reaction was, wow, let's turn it over. We have to hear that again. And I think we played the entire album all the way through three or four times, just listening, not before either of us spoke to each other and started discussing it. I'd never had that experience with any album ever before.
And I would guess nobody really prepared you to experience that it that way, because we didn't really know when we put that album on that the songs were going to seg and that there would be this sort of unifying thing going on. So it must have been a bit unexpected.
Yeah, absolutely. To my untrained ears at the time, I did not care for Revolver all that much, but I saw Revolver as sort of a way out extension of Rubber Soul, which was an album I was thoroughly immersed in. But then when Sgt. Pepper came along, it had no connection to Revolver at all, or anything anybody had ever done up to that time. It really was groundbreaking.
And then what about this physical package? I mean, when you compare album covers from Rubber Soul to Revolver, I mean, Revolver actually did have some of this sort of collage sensibility to it, but I'm hearing from people that just the experience of studying this album cover and having an interactive adventure with it was significant too. How about for you?
Absolutely. The album cover for Sgt. Pepper, it was, I guess, maybe the precursor to Where's Waldo. It was absolutely fascinating to stare at it for hours on end and try to work out who all the different people were, why they were standing where they were, what the facial expressions meant. I remember being especially fascinated by the Toussaint's dummies of the early Beatles. And it was very clear to me, even at that young age, that the message was, that was then, this is now. We're completely different people. Even the cardboard inserts, all of the packaging, just being able to handle these things. I mean, I made the terrible mistake of cutting them out and actually using them, which, of course, greatly diminished the collectible value of it. But, you know, you didn't care. You didn't even think about stuff like that in those days. It was a visceral experience. It was multimedia. Well before we ever knew what the word itself meant, or well before the word had been coined.
And so we've experienced 40 years of just about every artist, also including lyrics on their album. Can you talk about the groundbreaking nature of this album doing it, I think, for the first time?
Oh, I loved reading those lyrics. That was having the lyric sheets for Sgt. Pepper available was such an added bonus. I, like most Americans, didn't catch every single word of every single song because of the different inflections, and my ears weren't attuned to a British accent. But now, for the first time, you literally got to follow every word of every song, and it was probably the first time it dawned on me that they were brilliant lyricists as well as musicians. Of course, in those days, we didn't realize that John wrote his songs and Paul wrote his songs, and they weren't actually working together as a team. But I remember being fascinated by the fact that these two guys were writing such lyrical, almost like poetry, the way that the imagery that was conjured up by songs like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds or Benefit of Mr. Kite. You felt like you were there, and it was a combination of the words and the music and the production, of course, which put you in those spaces.
Well, by that time, there were already people who were starting to talk about Dylan's poetry, Paul Simon's poetry, and that sort of thing. But still, even though it was being talked that way, record companies weren't packaging lyrics up until this very moment.
Right, right. Yeah. And again, to my own embarrassment, I have to admit that in those days I was not a Dylan fan. I focused on his the tonality of his voice rather than the brilliance of his lyrics. And as a result, missed out on a lot of the great early stuff that he did. But having lyrics in front of you, it, to me, it just sort of completed the equation. It was like the icing on the cake. Along with the packaging and along with the production, being able to follow the songs along and hear, you know, make out every word clearly, listening with American ears to English people trying to sound like American artists. For the first time, it just opened up a whole new world for me.
Right. Well, and in a year that was kind of associated with sensory overload, this was almost the perfect reflection of it.
Totally, totally. That's a very good observation.
So you had the pleasure of working closely with Jeff Emmerich on this book of his, and I'm hoping that you might be able to share what you feel like are some of the more engaging kind of stories behind the recording of this Pepper album. As my notes said to you, most people say that the production sound on Pepper was just remarkable for the time and even still today. So could you pick a few stories about these songs where you could point to particular production
sure
stories?
I mean, I have to say, first of all, that it's still a thrill for me to hear the phone ring and pick it up and realize that Jeff is on the other end of the line. We spent 5 years working on this book, and we knew each other for a couple of years before. And as privileged as I am to have been his co-author, I'm even more privileged to have become close friends with him. And not only to hear the stories that he remembered from those days, but equally thrilling to have met Richard Lush and Phil McDonald, the two assistant engineers who worked with him on those sessions, and really kind of get the picture from the entire recording team. I have spoken with George Martin as well, although not specifically for this book. And so I kind of feel like somebody's in a very unique position. I'm really very honored to have been in contact with all four of the guys who were in that control room for those long 6 months that the Beatles were doing this album. And kind of feel like I have a pretty good handle on the overall perspective, not necessarily just viewing it through Jeff's eyes, but viewing it through the eyes of all the guys who were there. Excuse me. One of the most surprising things to me in talking with Jeff about this album was the realization, was learning that there had been an absolute, conscious, deep discussion the very first night of the session about the fact that they felt this album was going to be freeing because they'd made this decision not to tour. And neither Jeff nor George Martin had any knowledge of this beforehand. It had not been announced in the papers, and apparently Brian Epstein had not told George Martin, because this first evening Jeff had a very clear memory, as did Phil McDonald, of everyone gathering around the console in the control room, and John very excitedly explaining to George Martin that they were going to go for something really completely different with this album, because they were no longer constrained by having to think in terms of playing any of these songs live anymore. And apparently it took a bit of time for this to sink in with George, because there had never been an artist before or a band before that didn't tour. This alone was a precedent. In 1967, you made a record and you went out and you toured and you promoted it, and everybody played live gigs. And here, for one of many first times, the Beatles were turning the music world upside down and doing something completely different. So I guess it never occurred to me that there was this absolute conscious decision, and that there had actually been a conversation the first night of the sessions discussing the fact that they no longer had to think in terms of ever performing these songs live, and that both John and Paul felt it was going to be extremely freeing, that they could then now go for sounds that they didn't have to worry about recreating live, and they could layer parts and do all sorts of deep, detailed production work, because it didn't matter what it ever sounded like on stage, because they had no intention of ever playing it on stage. That was a revelation to me. I'm sorry, Paul.
Well, just to follow up on that, and maybe we'll get back to this anyway, but, you know, I know that the Beatles, John, and actually Paul in particular, were sort of intrigued with the pop art scene and the sound collage scene, the multimedia expressions of the day. I'm wondering if, you know, that their exposure to that sort of thing started to peek in on Revolver, but then, you know, with this decision definitely became part of the production that especially followed on the next two or three albums.
Well, absolutely. That avant-garde exposure and interest was a big part of Sgt. Pepper, and to some degree, as you said, with Revolver. The big difference was that at the end of Revolver, they knew they had a big tour to go off on, and they had half an eye while they were recording Revolver on learning the songs to perform on stage. And in fact, they did try to do some of the Revolver songs on stage with apparently not very good success. If you hear, for example, some of the outtakes of them attempting Paperback Writer, which was recorded during the Revolver sessions, it's really... It doesn't work very well live, because you don't have nine voices. You have only two voices or three voices doing the parts. The big difference really was this decision to stop touring and this realization that they did no longer had to think about reproducing these things live. And I think that's the most significant... That's the turning point in the Beatles' career. To me, you could measure everything they did up until 1966 and sort of put it in one basket. That was the live Beatles, that was the touring Beatles, that was the performing Beatles. And everything from Sgt. Pepper onward to the end of their career, that was the Beatles creating art in a recording studio with no thought whatsoever to live performance.
Right, okay. And so you were about to move to a second point, I think, before I diverted you, when you were talking about first that there was this sort of conscious... decision. And, you know, then I had asked a bit ago to, you know, zoom in on particular songs or stories that, you know, had intriguing tales.
Well, a second realization that was new to me was Jeff felt very strongly that Sgt. Pepper was kind of like two albums. He felt that at about the halfway point after the first five songs were recorded, that there was a distinct change in attitude, especially from John, and to some degree from Paul. The first songs they did, of course, were Strawberry Fields Forever, which they spent a lot of time on, and then Penny Lane, and then When I'm 64. And then they moved on to A Day in the Life, which they spent an enormous amount of time conceptualizing and working on. And it all, of course, led up to this momentous session where the orchestra came in and did that sort of orgasmic climb from lowest note to highest note, and the big piano chord at the end, and all of these phenomenal innovations and free thinking. And after that, it seemed to Jeff as if John kind of, I don't know, for want of a better word, withdrew. He was getting more and more into drugs, LSD in particular. And it's almost as if he'd given it his all with Strawberry Fields Forever and A Day in the Life, which to this day most people feel are among his greatest works. And Jeff felt that after that, John kind of played a much lesser role in the making of the album. And at the same time, Paul's influence began getting greater and greater. And if you listen to some of the outtakes that are on Anthology, you can clearly hear in Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, for example, which is a John Lennon song, Paul's the one giving him direction on how to sing it, not George Martin. And Jeff felt that after this halfway point, as John began withdrawing and Paul began asserting himself more, that George Martin also began fading into the background and became less involved in the everyday aspects of the album. He was certainly key in the orchestral arrangements, and certainly the band still were interested in his opinion. But George began... Well, one thing is that these sessions for Pepper began starting later and later and running later and later, whereas the Revolver sessions had been done almost entirely in the afternoons and would end in early evening. The Pepper sessions very often wouldn't even start until 7, 8, 9 o'clock, sometimes as late as midnight. And they typically worked through the night. And George Martin had responsibilities. He had to be in the office at 9 or 10 the next morning. He was not a Beatles employee. He was not an Abbey Road employee. He had his own production company. And so as Jeff and Richard Lush and Phil McDonald related it to me, very often by around midnight, they'd see George Martin starting to nod off. And very often at around 1 in the morning, he would leave. He would say goodnight and leave them to it. And so it would be the four Beatles plus Jeff and either Richard or Phil doing this all-night session with them until dawn the next day. So without meaning to sound in any way disrespectful to George Martin, he made a phenomenal contribution, but Jeff did see a lessening of his role and a lessening of John Lennon's role, and at the same time an increasing of Paul's role in the latter part of the album. That was an interesting revelation to me. That was something that I'd never heard before and had never occurred to me. But there are people who, notably Elvis Costello, who wrote a very kind and generous foreword to the book, who feel that Jeff really was the co-producer of the album, by modern definitions. I don't think Jeff himself would agree with that. I've certainly never heard him say that. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of the Sgt. Pepper album was recorded with George Martin out of the room. And I think that's worth noting.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some favorite listening moments on the album, particularly now that you know some of the stories behind how they were created?
Excuse me. I'm a bass player, and so I was always struck by the incredible bass sounds on Sgt. Pepper. To me, nobody has matched them since, and they are some of the finest bass sounds ever put down on tape or on vinyl or on disc or whatever you want to call it. And that certainly was a combination of Paul McCartney's playing, and you could argue that he peaked as a bass player with this album in terms of the incredibly intricate and melodic bass lines he came up with. But it's also, I think, in large part down to Jeff's contribution and the way that he mic'd the bass, which was unique, that nobody had ever done before.
Let me jump in and ask you, again, because of the scattered nature of pulling these cuts, to any time you mention Jeff, let's go ahead and say his full name.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
So pick up on, you know, in addition to McCartney's great playing, blah, blah, blah.
But a lot of the bass sounds, a lot of the uniqueness of the bass sounds on Sgt. Pepper, I think, came down to the way that their engineer, Jeff Emmerich, recorded the bass. And he took a very different approach. Almost all of Paul's bass lines on Sgt. Pepper were overdubbed afterwards, and apparently were normally done after the tracks were either complete or nearly complete. And that in itself was a very unusual approach. It was a conscious decision made by Paul because he wanted all of the music to be there for the bass to work off of. Normally the bass is recorded at the very beginning with the drums, and then you add other layers on top of it. So because Paul was determined to overdub the bass, Jeff Emmerich always needed to leave a separate track for him to record on. And this gave Paul the freedom. Because he wasn't playing with any of the other musicians live. And very often, he'd be doing this extremely late at night after even the rest of the band had gone home. Very often, it was just Paul sitting in the studio with Jeff Emmerich and his assistant engineer, and it was just the three of them. So because there were no other musicians playing, because there was no other overdub going on at the same time, Jeff was able to bring Paul's bass amp out into the middle of Studio 2 in Abbey Road instead of the corner where it normally was kept. And he was able to take a microphone and place it 3, 4, 5, 6 feet away as opposed to right up against the grill. And he was able to set the microphone in what's known as a figure of eight pattern so that it picked up ambient sound equally with the direct sound coming from the amp. And with the special combination of compressors and equalization that he used, and of course, with Paul's incredible playing and determination to get every note to speak and sing correctly. That's kind of a musician's term, that basically he's working on making every single note sound as good and full as it possibly can, and that comes only from the fingers. And Paul was willing to put in hour after hour after hour to do this. There was no, oh, that's good enough. It was every note had to be perfect. And he had been a perfectionist long before they started work on Sgt. Pepper, and I think maybe he got even more so during that album. It was a combination of all these things together. Paul's playing, Jeff Emmerich's approach to recording, the willingness to spend however long it took to get it right, and Paul's decision to put the bass on last after the other instruments were there. The combination of all these things is what made for such a unique sound, and it's never been repeated since.
So could you point out a song or two where that's more easily heard?
The highlight for me of the whole album is the song that Ringo sings. For,
with a little help from my friends.
With a little help from my friends. That was a song that the story that Jeff told was very interesting. They apparently put the backing track to that song down fairly quickly. It was recorded. It was one of the last songs recorded for the album. And that afternoon, the Beatles had actually done the photo shoot of the cover of the album with Peter Blake. And so they arrived unusually late, more like midnight or 1 a.m, which was late even for them. And they knocked out the backing track to a little help from my friends fairly quickly in the space of 3 or 4 hours. And it was nearly dawn when Ringo got up from behind his drum kit and began walking up the steps, which was normally the signal for Jeff and the other engineers that the session was about to end. Except this time, Paul called out after him, "Where are you going?" And Ringo said, "I'm knackered, I'm going home to bed." And Paul said, "No, come on down here and sing it." And John sided with him, and George Harrison sided with him, and they convinced Ringo to come down and do that vocal, which he did at dawn, after working all day and recording all night. After all of that was done, the next day Paul came in on his own and overdubbed the bass onto it. And the bass lines in that song are just beyond belief to my ears. Richard Lush had a very clear memory of having to drop in and out almost every bar. Not because Paul couldn't play the parts, not because he was making mistakes, because he was determined to get every line to sing perfectly. And that was one of those overdubs that was done, as I said, just with Jeff Emmerich and Richard Lush in the room. So that's one of the highlights of the song. Lovely Rita Metermaid has got also extremely complex, interesting bass line. Pretty much all of the songs on Sgt. Pepper, the bass lines just absolutely stick out.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Maybe another story or two. I know that your research and experience we could go track by track, but let's pick a couple of other highlights.
Sure.
That mean the most to you.
Sure. Within You, Without You is, I think, also a very interesting story. George Harrison has himself said in interviews that he really wasn't all that into the Sgt. Pepper recording experience. His heart was in India the whole time. I think that's the way he's phrased it. And he was fairly detached from a lot of the recording work. Paul did a lot of the lead guitar work instead. And when George Harrison finally did come in with his song, because at this point, well, he'd had 3 songs on the Revolver album, but that seems to have been a little bit of an aberration. Nobody really knows what politicking went on behind the scenes to do that. But it seems to have been predetermined that he was going to get 1 song on this album. And the first song that he brought in, frankly, was one of his lesser efforts and was not accepted. It was the song that eventually became Only a Northern Song which the Beatles later used on Yellow Submarine. But John and Paul apparently felt that it was not up to the standard of the rest of the songs, and even though they spent a couple of evenings working on it, it was kind of quietly shelved, and I guess George was asked to go away and come back with something better. And what he came back with a few weeks later was Within You, Without You, which Jeff Emerick tells me that when George first played it for them on acoustic guitar, nobody was especially impressed. Nobody really could understand the vision that he had or what the song would become, because the song itself was really made by the Indian musicians who George brought in to supplement it, as well as the orchestral score that George Martin put together. And it's interesting to me that during the week or two that they're spending doing this song, Jeff's recounting of it, you can see his admiration for George Harrison just grow and grow and grow. And the final session for Sgt. Pepper, the final recording session, took place with Paul McCartney out of the country. He was on his way back to America to see his girlfriend. So it was just George, John, and Ringo. And John and Ringo were just observers. Just George working with these Indian musicians, a very late night, all-night session, with George Martin conducting an orchestra, and they put together this marvelous Eastern-Western score, where you have the Indian musicians playing Eastern scales, and the Western musicians answering them in Western scales. And according to Jeff, it was a very, very difficult session. It took a very long time for the orchestral musicians to get the parts down. It was a very complex score. And at the end of this very long, spiritual, magical night, and these are words that Jeff has used, George finally sat down, cross-legged on the carpet, and began playing first his sitar solo, and then singing his vocal. And the vocal in Within You, Without You sound, it's got this very kind of spooky, laid-back, late-at-night, dawn kind of sound, and that's because that's exactly when it was recorded. Again, after a very long night of work, when there was this kind of calm peace after the storm. And I think that's an exceptionally magical track, and there are all these reasons why. And Jeff has said to me that it was that evening, while they were working on that track, that for the first time he felt that George Harrison was happy and comfortable during the Pepper sessions, that he was in his element, he was with people that he knew and trusted, and he must have realized he was creating something really great.
Well, yeah, and it's an indication that he may have been the first person who was taking a broad step away from the comfort of the Fabs, you know, because...
Yeah, it's very interesting, Jeff. In the course of talking through these sessions, Jeff and Phil McDonald both told me separately that they had the sense, just instinctively, nothing was said, they had the sense as far back as the Revolver sessions that George Harrison really wanted out, that he really didn't want to be a Beatle anymore, that he was sticking it out for the sake of not letting down the team, because these guys were his friends. And it was very interesting for me to read an interview with his widow Olivia a few years ago, where she said that George told her pretty much just that at the height of the Fabs days, he really didn't want to be a Beatle anymore, and he did it because he didn't want to let them down. And I think that probably really manifested itself during the Sgt. Pepper sessions, when George was kind of conspicuous by his absence for a lot of them. He was the only one of the four Beatles, for example, that didn't play that big piano chord at the end of A Day in the Life. And they had to recruit their roadie, Mal Evans, to kind of take his place. Jeff Emerick told me that when George finally did turn up late after everything had been recorded, John was kind of giving him a hard time and saying, you know, you've just missed out on the most important overdub we've done.
Some people, several folks I've talked with, talk about the heaviness of the guitar, particularly the first strains of Sgt. Pepper. Most of the books I've seen credit McCartney and or Harrison for guitar playing on that song and others. Do you know from your conversations with Jeff, who was actually hitting those first notes of the album?
I don't know who specifically played the first notes, but Jeff and Richard Lush and Phil all had a clear recollection of Paul doing a lot of the lead work on the Pepper mm-hmm. album, either through impatience or... Well, I think what would happen is very often he'd be the first to turn up at the session because he lived nearby in St. John's Wood, whereas the other three Beatles were coming in from the suburbs. And what would happen very often is Paul would get there an hour or two or three ahead of the others, and he'd just be impatient, and he'd say, let's lay down a part. And he'd grab a guitar just as readily as his bass.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't tell you specifically who played what, but... certainly the impression I got was that the majority of the lead work was done by Paul on that album.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I guess I'll let you pull another one out of the hat in terms of something that you think is intriguing about stories behind these songs.
Well, one interesting story that I'd never heard before. excuse me.
Need a sip of water?
No, I'm good. I'm good. Okay. Being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, George Martin has done many, many interviews through the years where he's described the technique by which he had his engineer, Jeff Emmerich, record various organs and calliope music off of sound effects records, and then instructed him to cut the tape in small pieces, toss the pieces up in the air, and reconnect them so that the end result was a almost random music concrete kind of effect. This came because John Lennon's direction to George was that he wanted to smell the sawdust. He wanted the listener to be able to feel like they were at the fairgrounds. And this solution that George Martin came up with was ingenious, and it absolutely worked, and it worked well. And everything in that story is true and verified by both Jeff and Richard Lush, who were there. What isn't known, and what George Martin doesn't seem to remember, is that they'd actually done the same thing a year before during the Revolver sessions. That it wasn't a brand new glimmer of an idea that sort of hit him in the middle of thinking about it. If you listen closely to the solo in the middle of the song Yellow Submarine, you hear what appears to be a brass band playing something very odd that ends very quickly and abruptly, and it's only about three bars long. What happened there was that for the Revolver sessions, the Beatles were under time pressure. There was, as I said, a tour coming up, and there was a drop-dead date by which they had to finish the album, unlike Pepper, which they just worked on until they decided it was done. And in the song Yellow Submarine, they left a gap for a solo. They tried a guitar solo, didn't seem to work. They tried a piano solo, it didn't seem to work. They tried an organ solo, it didn't seem to work. And eventually they got the idea, I don't know if it was Paul's idea or George Martin's idea, to have a brass band come in and play a solo. And George Martin was aghast. He said, we don't have time to do it, and B, we don't have the budget to bring a brass band in here. So they came up with a very similar idea. They had Jeff record snatches of Sousa marches. They had him cut up the tape. They had him toss the pieces in the air. They had him recombine them together. And they had to fade it out very quickly because if the music had played another second or two longer under British copyright law, they would have had to pay royalties. And George Martin, of course, was cognizant of budget. So when they pulled out this trick for being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, it worked beautifully. It did the job. But it certainly was not the first time the Beatles had done that, or George Martin had done that.
Mm-hmm. Good story, yeah. I wanted to ask you to try, based on your knowledge of the era, to place this record in a context of what else was going on in Britain and America. Is there a way to explore that in a...
Well, everything was starting to get a little bit heavier. I believe Hendrix, I don't have the exact dates in front of me, but I believe Hendrix had already come out.
Hendrix was already playing in England, but his first album came out, maybe a month after Pepper.
Okay. And I think Cream might have been after Pepper also.
Cream was just a bit before in terms of issuing their first album.
Okay. Certainly... I mean, psychedelia seemed to have, I don't know if it had run its course, but it seemed to be on the downside. I think Revolver touched off this stream of quote-unquote psychedelic songs. In particular, Tomorrow Never Knows was a huge influence. And it seemed like you had a lot of bands just kind of doing these monotonic sound pictures that didn't necessarily have a tremendous amount of musical content. And unless you were under the influence of something, maybe you couldn't really appreciate it.
Is that like Pink Floyd in England? Or?
Yeah, Pink Floyd would be a good case in point, or early Jefferson Airplane, or even some of the odder stuff on Pet Sounds.
By the Beach Boys.
But I think things were beginning to get a little bit heavier, and it's difficult for me to recall those days precisely, but guitars were getting louder, things were getting more pared down. And that's why Sgt. Pepper was so different and so unique. It didn't seem to be following the trend at all. It seemed to be, we're going to set a new trend. To me, the most significant thing culturally about Pepper is that before Sgt. Pepper, pop musicians wanted to make good pop records. After Sgt. Pepper, pop musicians wanted to make art. And I think that's the single most telling thing. Pepper was not only a great album that you could enjoy and dance to and listen to, but everyone from the most unschooled teenager to the most finely tuned trained music critic acknowledged that this was an important work of art, that this was something that would stand the test of time, as I believe it has, and as I believe it will.
Well, Howard, I think that feels like a pretty good place to stop. I had promised you about 40 minutes or so, and it's clear from our rapport that we could go back and forth on little intricacies about this time and this piece, but I also have lots of other interviews that I've done, and we'll be weaving this stuff in and out. So was there something that you were just kind of itching to talk about for this that would fall under a last call? Any particular track or moment or impression that...
The only thing that I was thinking I might talk about a little bit was Strawberry Fields Forever, which was done during the Pepper sessions but was not on the Pepper album. So I don't know if that falls under your purview.
Yeah, it probably will. I forget which of my commentators, but, several people have talked, about the... construction of it, and I do have, this bootleg recording of all the different iterations of it from Lennon's early at-home demos all the way through.
Okay. Then you've probably got that covered. The only story with Sgt. Pepper that was, because I'd kind of been a little bit of a Beatles scholar even before I started this book. But the one part of the story that I didn't know before I met Jeff was that during that first minute of before the splice,
on Strawberry Fields,
Forever, it's common knowledge that the first take, the first bit of Sgt. Pepper had to be speeded up a little bit, had to be sped up a little bit. In order to match the pitch.
You said Sgt. Pepper. Did you mean Strawberry
Fields? I'm sorry.
Fields?
Let me start again. Yeah. It's common knowledge that the first section of Strawberry Fields Forever had to be sped up a little bit in order to match the pitch and tempo of the second section, which had to be slowed down a little bit. And the splice comes in at just about exactly 1 minute into the song. What I didn't know until I met Jeff Emmerich was that throughout that first minute, the speed is it's actually speeding up slowly from start to finish. It's not playing at a constant speed during that first minute. It began at the normal speed, and he slowly sped it up using a very speed control throughout that first minute. And it was very arduous, painstaking process, A, to make that occur without it being obvious. And I defy anyone listening to that to say, oh, I hear it speeding up. You really don't. And, of course, to get it to precisely that point at precisely where the edit was going to be. The other thing that I found interesting and didn't know was that they didn't have editing blocks and razor blades at Abbey Road. They used non-magnetized brass scissors. And so Jeff Emmerich literally had to cut the tape with a pair of scissors between the two splices. And as he described it, it was a very, very shallow cut because they really wanted it to be more of a crossfade than an actual butt splice or tight edit between the two parts. So from a technical point of view, those were two things I found fascinating.
Well, it's hard to imagine being able to... Were they making diagonal cuts?
Yeah, yeah, they were making diagonal...
So they were just eyeballing it, essentially.
Well, Jeff said when you started work at Abbey Road, you were encouraged to spend long hours practicing this, so that after a while, you sort of instinctively knew what angle to cut the tape. But that for this particular edit, he had to change the angle, because when he cut it at that normal angle, it was too obvious. So he had to cut it at a much, not a steeper angle, a much more shallow angle. So it was really more like a crossfade between the two parts.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's amazing stuff.
That may be a detail that only those of us that have spent time at an editing block really absorb, but I sure am getting it.
Yeah, it was just fascinating to me as a recording engineer. First, the idea that you wouldn't have an editing block and a razor blade was interesting enough, but the idea that you had to kind of improvise even the angle at which you cut the tape was pretty phenomenal. The other part of the story that you may or may not find interesting or worth including is while Jeff Emmerich and George Martin were working on perfecting this edit and getting the speeds and tempos and pitches to match up, took them quite a long time. They spent many hours in the control room working on this. And this was an evening when the Beatles could not get into Studio 2 for some reason. Some other artists had been booked there. So they were working in a different studio. And so the band were sitting downstairs or sitting outside in the recording studio, but they didn't have their equipment. And so they couldn't jam. They couldn't really be doing much of anything. They were just kind of sitting around twiddling their thumbs and getting more and more impatient. And John, who was renowned for being exceedingly impatient, at one point kind of burst into the control room and said, "Aren't you lot done yet?" And Paul was tailing behind. It was Paul who kind of talked him out of this. And Jeff remembered Paul explaining the job to John and saying, "It's a process. You can't hurry these things. It's a process." It was just a little personal anecdote I found very interesting. You could sort of imagine the yin-yang between the two leaders of the group. You know, one kind of saying, "Aren't you done yet?" and the other trying to calm him down. It's an interesting image for me.
Yeah, yeah, right. It cuts to the heart of their personality.
I think so. I think so.
Yeah. Howard Massey is co-author with Beatles engineer Jeff Emmerich of the book Here, There, and Everywhere. He's also a recording engineer in his own right. And I want to thank you for joining us today and talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul.